Hey, how are you guys? Welcome to Ari Shaffir's Skeptic Tank. On today's episode, I talked to my friend and co-Jew, Mr. Moshe Kasher. Moshe, I don't know if you guys know this or not, is the Hebrew word for Moses. Moses is in the abridged version of the Bible. I'm just kidding. I don't care. I don't give a fuck either way. But Moshe had this weird upbringing where he would have this... Well, we'll talk about it in the podcast, but he had to split custody between his parents, and his mother was pretty not religious, and his father, who we went to live with 6 weeks a year, I think that's right, was super, super Orthodox, Satmar Hasid, and he had to live like that every summer. It's really, really weird. So we get into that and a bunch of other stuff, as always. It was a fun conversation. The Moshe's hilarious, by the way. If you guys ever get a chance to see him, if he's in your town, you should definitely watch him. He's very, very funny. And that's it. He did my storyteller show in Portland, and he had one of the best stories, probably one of the best four, five, six stories I've had since the run of this has happened. We didn't get it on tape. It's gone forever to the ether, but it was an amazing one. And... this storyteller show, December 7th, at the Hollywood Improv. Russell Peters is doing it now. He just told me tonight. So it's all virginity stories. It's all stories of how we lost our virginities. I'm doing it. Russell Peters is doing it. Steve Renazzisi from The League. Kevin Christie. Who else? John Reap. Mark Maron. It's a great fucking lineup, as I say it. And a special guest that I can't say because they're a celebrity. But they're coming in too. Not a movie star or anything. Relax. Get your expectations down a little bit. It's not fucking Brad Pitt that's going to come in. But it's a great lineup, and it's $5. It's called This Is Not Happening is the name of our storyteller series. If you guys listen, then I think I'm boring you with these already. So it's December 7th. The next one after this is January 3rd. Also at the Improv. I haven't picked a topic yet for that. And then at the end of January, I'll be in Minnesota. Not in Minnesota. Yeah, Minneapolis. That's Minnesota, right? Hi, I'm a product of private schooling. At House of Comedy in the Mall of America. So, go to that if you live there. And that's it, everybody. Enjoy Ari Shaffir's Skeptic Tank, episode 35, I think, and hope, with Moshe Kasher. Here we are. Moshe Kasher. How
That's
are
how
you?
It starts?
Well, I do it like an intro beforehand, and I say what I'm going to talk about.
That's pretty low rent, dude.
Yeah. I pick out like a theme song in between that, too.
Oh,
and
all
I
right.
What
Man, that was a good song. That was quite a song, Ari. Well, how'd you pick that one?
You just thought about it for a while. Right. I entered a couple search engines.
Yeah, that was
and
good,
that helped
man.
Me a lot.
I feel comfortable and ready to banter with you now.
Thanks, Moshe. I want to talk to you about your crazy religious upbringing or whatever you had. You told some story in Portland at my storyteller show.
Yeah, that was fun, huh?
That was one of the best stories we've had in that storyteller show.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt it was. Definitely.
What a cocksucker.
That was fun, though, man. It was weird because I don't usually tell. I mean, it's like
it's serious?
It has serious elements to it. I mean, the book that I'm writing is got tons of serious shit in it, you know. But
it's easier in a book. You don't have to.
Yeah, you just push it away from you, and like it's over there. It's not you saying it, kind of a thing.
I feel like whenever I say something serious on stage, I just want to glance over it.
Right.
My tendency is to want to be like whatever happened. Like let's say it's molestation. It's not,
right.
I'm like it's someone very raped me. I'm fine with it.
Yeah.
Let's move on. But the point is,
I was raped. Here's the funny part, though.
Yeah.
I mean, there are comics out there, right, who do that kind of stuff, right?
Get serious at moments.
Yeah, like Robert Schimmel apparently used to do this big thing, right? I never saw
really,
it.
Really, about
big...
getting over cancer?
Yeah,
about
getting
over.
Yeah, it was like there's something, and then there's... Actually, I don't actually know what I'm talking about. I think they do that. Pryor used to do stuff like that, didn't he?
Towards the end, I heard everybody got stagged because it was all, like, diseased out, and he could barely speak and had to go up in a wheelchair.
See, that sounds serious.
At that point, it's like, dude, you're making everyone sad just looking at you.
Oh, man.
You need to either kill yourself or just not show up here.
Yeah, Pryor. It's time somebody took Richard Pryor down a peg, man.
There were like five like so stories like that got a little serious that we've had. Like you, Ralphie did one like that.
Ralphie May?
Uh-huh.
Oh, wow. About his cholesterol?
Yeah. Well, it's about just sports in general, but how we like... got into a car accident on the way home from some sporting event. And,
oh, Bill Burr on The Moth. Have you ever heard that?
I haven't. No, I fucking. Wait, which one did you? Maybe I did. I know I was supposed to look at it.
Something about this. It's a sad story. I mean, straight up. It's not funny, actually.
Really?
It's just straight up sad. Oh, and of course, there's Mike DiStefano on WTF tells this unbelievably sad story. And
about getting
beautiful and
AIDS and whatever.
But he had AIDS and his wife had AIDS. This wasn't a coincidence. I don't think. He didn't give it to her. It's just they both had AIDS. They had met at like an AIDS.
That'd be a great website to go to, AIDSforAIDS.com.
Well, that's what I was talking to somebody about the other day. Like, if you're this is how intensely sexual men are. Uh-huh. If you're a gay man with AIDS, it barely affects your sex life. Like, it'll affect it a little bit. There's like 5% of dudes who are like, I'm good. But if you are a straight man with AIDS, you're essentially
For you forever.
You're fucked, dude. Yeah. You're either
you can only fuck other people with AIDS, or you can
go to AIDSforAIDS.com. Like,
do they have that
about.
Website?
No, but I thought we were gonna start
Somebody
it.
Somebody get on that. Yeah,
you can like hope to make a woman fall in love with you. You know, which can happen. You know,
yeah, but you have to hide the AIDS from her for a while.
Nah, because then it could be a big thing. Like, it'd be like M. Butterfly.
You could say you got it like or later. M. Butterfly.
You ever see M. Butterfly?
I think I read the play when I was
in
college.
Like Jeremy Irons or whatever. Yeah, it's a play
he
too.
Pretends he's a
pretends.
A chick.
Yeah, he pretends he's dating a chick for like 5 years, and then in the end, she's like, I was a man
about my penis.
He's like, I didn't know. It's like you didn't know you were fucking someone's butt exclusively.
That's that weird Christian lose your virginity thing.
Yeah, totally.
I've known someone like that. They were like, I can't do it before we're married, but just go ahead and put it in the back.
Yeah. Well, all right. Here's one for you. All right.
Huge step up. What?
And then we can get into my upbringing. We were talking about the ultimate deal breaker.
Yeah.
My friend dated this girl, and the first time they got sexual together, she was like, all right, here's the thing.
Yeah.
My pussy is broken.
Okay.
I feel searing pain whenever anything is inserted into it. And I know it sounds like I'm crazy and like it's a psychological thing. I've gone to doctors. It's a real thing.
Okay, hold on. Let me ask you a question.
Yes.
Is this happening while he's naked with a boner?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Because she's staring at it going, you're not putting that thing in my broken razor pussy. So she's like, so basically, and he kind of liked her, right?
Yeah.
She's like, basically, we can never have sex.
Oh.
Everything else is available to you. The ass, my mouth, anything you want. But we can never have regular sex. It's like the ultimate deal breaker.
Wow.
Yeah, you couldn't stick around.
I'm considering
that,
it right now, but I don't know if I could.
No, right? You like the girl a lot.
Yeah.
You don't want kids, right?
No, I don't want
kids. It doesn't matter.
That's a plus. Never in the birth canal. I like that. That's a definite plus.
But it's
David,
like,
Taylor had a friend that was barren once, and she said it at a party. She was kind of an ugly Jewish girl.
Yeah.
She mentioned she's barren, and immediately I was like, ooh.
You're like, zoinks! Yeah. All her ugliness started to melt into like Ashley Judd kind of good looks.
You just Why said Ashley the right Judd? Thing.
I've been watching a lot of Star Trek: The Next Generation. She was in an episode recently.
What was she in that?
I think it was Ashley Judd. Yeah, she was.
Was she in the one where the people get lost in the woods with Morgan Freeman? He's got to rescue them from some like
that's
hideout
glory.
In the woods.
That's glory.
No, no, not
it's not
that
Star
one.
Trek. Morgan Freeman was never in Star Trek.
No, not Star Trek. I'm saying this other movie.
Oh
not the
yeah.
Star Trek where they get lost in the woods.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm like Morgan. You mean LeVar Burton? Dude, you're so racist. That's not Morgan Freeman. Some black actor played Geordi LaForge.
Something was
Morgan
wrong
Freeman,
them.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, they're dated his daughter or like granddaughter, or he was blind.
Something.
One of those things.
He healed people in The Green Mile, right? That was Morgan Freeman, right?
It looks exactly the same. What was she in Star Trek Next Generation?
She was just like doing a guest star. She
Did you like
hot,
that show?
Man. I love it.
I loved it, too. It's
love
so cheese dickish now.
No.
Yes, it is.
I'm on episode 177 right now. I'm going through.
You're going
it again,
back
one episode at a time.
When I was in Yeshiva University, I used to watch like all the time, like early UPN and like.
You went to YU?
Yeah, for a year.
For what?
To lose my faith.
You lost your faith at YU?
Yeah.
Oh, that's hilarious. Were you in the rabbinate program or something?
I was in they had like the special like rabbinate program, then the regular everybody Orthodox program, which
yeah,
like 80%, and then they had like the unreligious people.
Well, what were you though?
Regular Orthodox.
You were going to be a rabbi.
No.
What were you trying to do?
Just study as much Torah as you could.
Did you ever?
You have to get to your regular life.
And interesting. And that's where you lost your faith.
Yeah, they split curriculum, so like it's until
right.
1 o'clock. It would just take.
Did you have a moment in the library where you were like, "Oh, life"? It's bigger. It's big, and you're tossing library books and Torahs from the shelf.
Take this, Navi.
Losing my religion.
Hey, what's he doing with that chumash?
And you're like jerking off by the end of the aisle.
My friend challenged me when I was telling him that I don't think I believed. He was like, "Well, if you don't believe, then go to the synagogue area. Go take the Torah and throw it on the ground then." And it's, I was like, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, why would you? A normal, non-religious person wouldn't do that.
Well, then, you know, set a baby on fire, bro. Yeah.
Wait, why? Why?
You don't believe in heaven, so just set a baby on fire. Like, what?
Speaking of nerdy things in Judaism, my brother, I was telling this story last night. My brother, who is a rabbi. Mm-hmm. Do you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
My brother is a rabbi, but he's normal. He went to a place that was a little bit more liberal than YU. So, but okay. It's Orthodox still. So
what
it's
place?
Like it's called Chovavei Torah. Do you know? It's like a. It's in New York. Yeah. They're all in New York. I just feel like all of your listeners are like, "What is anyone talking about?" Right?
They sort of get it if I find that like, if people know what they're talking about, the rest of the people sort of get it.
Well, here's the thing. So Judaism, obviously, as you know, is separated into three branches, three major branches, which is Orthodox, which are the most religious, Conservative, which are the middle people, and the Reform people, who are Christians. And I'm kidding.
They're like, what laws? Nah, we're not going to do that.
I'm joking. But but in the Orthodox
world. That's how we thought.
Yeah, right. Totally. In the Orthodox world, there's probably more variants in the Orthodox world than there is in either of the other ones.
And that's all pretty much you're trying to live by the 613 laws.
Right. Within some of the laws of
Black Hat people with the payas.
My family is Black Hat people with the payas.
Wow.
And my brother and I both grew up in that environment. But we also basically, okay, here's what happened.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Oakland.
Okay.
So I didn't grow up religious 90% of the time. Basically, here's what happened. My parents, they were sort of maybe conservative together when they were together.
Okay.
And when they split, my dad plunged back into the religiosity of our family lineage.
What is it about trauma that makes people go into religion?
Well, it's simple, right? It's like, you know, it's when you're looking for answers. There are answers. Oh. Right?
Living for a higher purpose.
All
right.
There are answers, yeah. What is the meaning of life? It's like all of a sudden somebody comes there with a golden plate.
Here it is.
Here's the meaning of life. You're like, cool, I didn't know what the fuck to do, so perfect.
That's why in prison they're always getting religious.
Totally. And yeah. It's like, you know, I need
something to live for. I can't just be in jail for the rest of my life.
Yeah, that's true too. But in some ways it's great. Like when my dad died. Oh, sorry. Spoiler alert.
God damn it.
When my dad died, like, have you ever had a close person die? It was a Jew kind of like parent,
no, not a,
brother,
not a,
different uh-uh. situation. That's awesome. You should try it.
Okay.
It's definitely a lot of fun. But what's crazy in that moment is when you have someone that close to you die, you just don't know what to do with yourself. And the Jewish ritual mourning thing is so easy.
It's great.
They're just like, do this. You don't
know
what
to
do.
They give you a bunch of commands. You have to tear your shirt, whatever you're wearing.
Start by tearing your shirt.
And then sit on a load.
Sit down on the ground and think about, I mean, it's just your grief has been codified. And I remember thinking when I was sitting there doing the grieving process for my dad, how do people do this that don't have Judaism?
They don't do it as well. The Jewish grieving process, it's the best.
The
for
best.
Grieving. Everything else I've seen, they're like, it just doesn't compete.
Straight killing it, dog.
Yeah.
I mean, we're killing it on entertainment and on grieving.
And straight grieving for a close relative.
Yeah, no doubt.
You can't leave your place for seven days, is that right?
Right, so you sit in your living room
and people come to
on
visit
the ground
you.
And people come to visit you. You can't even cook for yourself.
Right.
You know, you...
Oh, that's right. They bring you food.
You sort of, you sit there and you just, you know, you just deal.
Yeah.
With your grief. And people come and they tell you stories about the person that's passed.
So you don't have to move on. You don't have to be like, we still need that report due.
No, don't
like,
move on.
Nothing.
Sit here. Be with your grief. You, like, indulge in it.
Yeah.
Sit, don't even think about anything. Don't cook. Don't just sit there and listen to your family and talk to about your loved one that's gone and think about that person. And then, of course, at the end of 7 days of doing that, they say, cool, we're done now. Get up.
And then you get up.
You get up. You walk around. You leave the house for the first time in 7 days. You walk around the block.
Is that what you're supposed to do?
Well, so the idea is, in the kind of mystical tradition, is that the soul of the recently departed is still kind of, you know, hanging out in Shiva, which is the name of the grieving process.
But
he's
what
hanging
if,
out listening to these stories that you've been telling about him.
Oh,
right?
Like Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn when they fake their own deaths.
Exactly like Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn. The idea is that the soul goes through a process called Gilgul, which is where it turns into Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn. That is a straight up out of that's a theological
and that's
precept.
What Mark Twain was writing about.
That's
was
right.
His field goal that came back.
No, but then you get up at the end of the 7 days, and yeah. It's like, okay, time to get back into life. You walk around the block. So the idea is that you're walking the soul of this departed person around the block, and then you're kind of like as if setting them free.
Wow.
And in fact, setting yourself free, right? You're
right.
Like, cool. Then you go back to work, but you still have like, so that's 7 days. And then there's a 30-day period where there's other great mm-hmm. grief processes. Don't shave. Don't listen to music. Don't go to the movies. So you're still
shave for 30 days. Right, because you're not completely done grieving.
Right. You're still engaged in the process of grieving. It's just that you need to like take another step back into the world. At the end of the 30 days, you shave. You listen to music, whatever. But you still have a process. You still have a period of 1 full year.
Oh, yeah. You can't listen to music during that week.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
During the month. Then you have this process of a full year
yeah.
where you don't go to, like, you say the prayer of the mourner's mm-hmm. Kaddish for the whole year,
yeah.
and you don't, there's certain other things. So it's like these codified systems, these 7 days.
There's something to do after a year, too. What, visit the grave?
At the end of the year, you go and you visit, you visit the grave, and that's where you go back and you, like, you know, have like a little memory party or whatever, a memory party.
Yeah. Wait, what if you're mourning, let's say your mom, your sister died today.
You don't have one? Yeah, man.
Okay,
let's
perfect.
Hope.
So you're here mourning.
Yeah.
Your mom would be in wherever mourning.
Yeah.
But her soul's haunting both of you?
Oh, I mean, God, what do you think? This is a flawless system? Go fuck yourself. I mean, in fact, I'm pretty sure, though, that everybody, you're supposed to do Shiva together. You know, people are supposed to come
oh, really?
To do the Shiva together, like.
Oh yeah, you get a couple days like until the
yeah,
the
but
funeral.
You know,
the
funeral is done very hastily. Here's the process. This has become very
within
dark.
24 hours.
I've never
right?
really talked a lot about this.
Really,
the more the crazier details of what happens. I mean, for me, it was like it was a trip because I remember thinking because, like I said, I grew up in Oakland, pretty much a secular kid, and 6 weeks a year I would fly back home to visit my dad for visitation, and we would literally he would take us from the airport.
What's visitation? Oh, because when they split
up. Visitation is a Jewish concept where a judge, one of the judges, will mandate that the parent be allowed to see their kids,
mm-hmm.
or their what's called their wages will be docked.
Oh,
yeah.
The Beit Din is really
it's smart. Called it's a Hebrew term called deadbeat dad.
Oh, was your dad a deadbeat dad?
No, not at all. He was not.
Okay.
He fought for us for visitation, and so what we would do is when he won the visitation rights, we would fly into New York, we get picked up at the airport. Literally, my dad would pick us up at the airport.
Yeah,
and my dad actually he wouldn't. He had his my dad never drove his entire life.
Really,
he had his best friend who was just drive him wherever he was. Like my dad was like a fucking like a pimp.
I think Norm MacDonald is like that.
It's so weird. My dad's
really?
Best friend Billy Newman would pick him up at the airport. Drive him around, drop him off at home. Bill Newman never married or dated the whole time that I knew him growing
yeah.
up. He's my godfather. When my dad yeah. died, he got married 2 years later.
Really?
Yeah, and in my mind, I've always thought...
Dad was taking a place in his heart.
Yeah, like he could... Well, there was no space... Not like he had like some gay thing for my dad, but more like, there's no time for dating. I've got to take care of Stephen Kasher.
Because he can't drive
yeah.
for no reason. Why didn't he drive?
He didn't need to.
Oh, yeah.
Right? He just,
I guess it's New
my
York
dad
too.
Was the kind of guy that people like worshipped, you know what I mean? So, so when my dad got more religious, like all of our family on my dad's side was like super black hat Yiddish as a first language type of people,
yeah.
right? So when my mom left him, she essentially, you know, took us. Like she was like, "We're going
from
on
New
vacation."
York?
Yeah, she's like, "We're going on vacation. See ya." And we just never came back.
Wow. How old were you?
I was 9 months old.
Oh, okay.
And so when I got old, what do you mean? Oh, okay. Still wow. No,
it's less wow.
Ah, fuck
sorry.
You.
I lose respect for your trauma.
Ah, damn it. So then we, when he won visitation, I guess I was like 5 or 6 years old, we would yeah. fly back to New York. Billy Newman would pick us up and we would literally drive from the airport to the religious person barbershop. And they would try to cut our California haircut, cool kid bowl cuts.
Change it
into a religious haircut.
Whoa.
We would put on a button-up white, button-up, you know, rayon shirt.
Yeah.
I mean, a velvet yarmulke, slacks. And we would go be like tzitzit, Haredi, hanging out. Tzitzit hanging out, the little fringes of the Jewish
people.
You
just faked it?
And we would faked it. I mean, I became an expert at looking like I knew what was happening, and I never did.
That's like, what I did too when we moved in fourth grade.
Yeah.
My dad went to prison. We went to, moved in fourth grade, and we're like, we're religious now. And we're like, what? Uh-huh. Yeah, we. I just had. I remember praying with everybody else and seeing them all like doing it.
Right.
And I'm like, I don't even know what these words are. It's a different language.
Exactly.
I just counted from 1 to 10, like in my head.
You know what I would do? Is you know how? Yeah, exactly. So when, like, if you ever go to a really religious synagogue, everybody's kind of muttering the Hebrew to themselves, you know. And so that's what I would do. I would read it in English, and I would just sort of mutter.
Yeah, that's all people do. They try to say it as fast as possible, the same prayers.
But the difference maybe, I don't know what your how religious your shul was, but I couldn't really hide because no one had an English prayer book.
Oh.
Not any one person.
Wow.
So it was just me.
What sect was it?
Yeah, the Satmar.
Okay.
Who are the worst.
I think my dad.
They are, the Satmar are the most extreme of all of the Hasidic groups. So to put that into perspective.
Is that the Rebbe?
No, that's the Lubavitchers.
Yeah.
To put that in, I feel like I should be reading passages from my book, but to put this into perspective for your listeners, I'm saying that of all the fur hat, silk gown, Yiddish as a first language, shtetl living weirdos in the Hasidic world, the sect my dad fell into was the most outside the margins of society. And as I say in the book, this would be like being among the fattest of Walmart shoppers. It's pretty extreme.
He's like, screw it. I'm just going for the, let's go for the gold.
Well, he had a kind of sense memory and of that world. And my dad was nostalgic to the point of delusion. You know, I mean,
was he raised like that?
Yeah.
He
was. My great grandfather was not a Satmar Chassid, but was something called, in a community called Muncie, you know, Muncie.
Uh-huh.
And he was a Skver Chassid, which is, the Skvers are interesting. They are a village in upstate New York. And what's an interesting distinction, there's a number of weird things about them. One is that they are raised in a village, New Square, and the entire village of New Square, New York, voted for Hillary Clinton for Senate. That's how...
Really?
I mean, every single person.
They say, hey, we're voting for this.
The Rebbe says, vote for Hillary Clinton because she gave us money for this yeshiva, and they vote for it. And when they started, it's bizarre. When they started, they would have, I mean, these are my family.
All those sects are just named after the city they're from, right?
Yeah.
Pretty much.
So these are my family, right?
Yeah.
In fact, Satmar, interestingly, it's named after, Satmar is named after Satmar, I think Russia, which Satmar is Saint Mary. But the ironic thing is they're from Saint Mary, Russia, and their sect name is Saint Mary.
Wow, I didn't know that.
So anyway, so the Skverers, what's interesting about them is that they are a village. And they don't start learning. This is in New York. They don't start learning. It might be different now, but in the early days of it, they don't start learning English.
Wow.
Until they start. It's like vocation. When they start getting towards working age.
So they live in New York and just don't even.
They just know Yiddish.
Wow.
And if you were like the Yankees, they'd be like, "Vos ist der Yankee?" or whatever.
How do they get by in life? They don't deal with anyone else. They just deal with themselves.
Yeah, they have no need. What would they need? Well, they get by in life when they turn, I don't know, 16 or 17. They start learning English for business purposes.
Yeah.
And what
how do they pay the phone bill?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they have a one person that lives there, like
can do it.
English.
I guess the older people would
English
know.
Saul or something. Like, go to English Saul. And then English Saul's like, hi, it's me, Saul. And he does all, I don't know. Women don't drive in New Square. This is my family.
Wow.
If any of your listeners are not familiar with my act, I mean, I'm not talking about like...
No, you're not talking about any of this on stage.
I mean, this is, you know, I talk about pussy and things. I mean, I remember being in the Shiva when all these people would come over because once a day, you have to pray, you know, you have to say the mourner's prayer.
Yeah.
So once a day, 10 men will gather at your house to do it. And I remember looking around and just thinking, if my friends could like see what's happening right now, that this is a part of my life, it would boggle their fucking minds that this is me.
How long did you get visitation for?
6 weeks.
So you're there for six. Okay, so it was like
religious
camp.
For 6 weeks.
Wow.
And
then every year 6 weeks.
Every year 6 weeks until my life sort of started falling apart, and then it sort of started to peter off, and it got more complicated. But you know, I would go out there. You talk about Lubavitchers. A lot of people know who Lubavitchers are. The Chabad. They're the ones that do the telethon. They're the most famous sect. My dad, when I got to this Saint Satmar, you know, community, which was in a place called Seagate in New York,
Yeah.
I say in the book, like, see, well, here's how you get there. If you take the F train all the way to the very, very last stop, then you walk past Coney Island, past the people of color, past the projects, past a gate, through a gate, through a time portal into pre-Nazi Germany. You get into a shtetl in the middle of Europe. That's Seagate. That's
Is it really like that?
There. Oh, it's really like that.
Just backwards, like Amish, but for Jews.
I mean, sort of. They used to say, like, how do you tell the difference between an Amish guy and a Hasidic Jew? Is that the Hasidic Jew has a cell phone.
Right.
That's a joke that may or may not resonate with one person listening.
But, I probably have like 7 Jewish listeners.
Yeah.
I think they're amazed at this sort of life, though.
It's crazy. It's like happening now.
Did your dad, was he at all like, I know you guys aren't into this, but I want you to do it for me?
My dad was actually in the realm of things. I don't feel particularly traumatized by the way my dad was about it. He was never like fire and brimstone. If you don't do this, you're going to go to hell. It was always more like, isn't this beautiful? This thing that we do, isn't this amazing? And it was definitely like, you should do this, but it was never like, you're a sinner. Your life is, it was more
so
like,
when you went back, he wasn't like, and don't eat Big Macs while you're there.
While
you're in Oakland. I think he
knew better than to say something. He would have loved for me to not eat Big Macs, but it was sort of this suspension of disbelief that was happening. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, I asked my Rebbe in Israel if I should have, because I had all these friends who were fucking non-Jewish girls.
Yeah.
And I was like, is my responsibility to tell them not to fuck, to start, you didn't use that word with them.
Right.
But I was like,
yo, Rebbe, what's up? Hey, I got these motherfuckers getting pussy, but it's straight non-Jewish pussy. What's up?
Actually, the punishment for having premarital sex with a non-Jewish woman is almost nothing.
Oh, right.
It's about the same as masturbation.
No, no doubt. Yeah.
But having sex with a Jewish woman who's unclean, who's had her period,
it's all bad.
That's super bad. Yeah. So it's like, should I tell them to have to date Jewish girls if that means they're going to have sex with them and thereby sin way more?
Well, you're talking about the episode of this podcast with Michael Black, who only goes to prostitutes
only
now?
Only goes to prostitutes, yeah.
Have you ever read the part, and there's a part in the Talmud that says, there's a book called by Nathan Englander called For Relief of Unbearable Urges, and it's based on this passage, and it's a short story about this guy that goes to a rabbi, and he's like, I can't deal with it, I need to, I'm so horny, blah, blah, blah.
Find a non-Jewish girl.
Find a prostitute. Literally, it says, dress in all black.
Dress in all black?
Go to a neighboring village, find a non-Jewish prostitute, handle your business, and come back and be a regular dude. If you can't deal with it, if it's getting to the point that you can't deal with your horniness, go do
it. Oh, that's great.
Yeah, man. It's the greatest religion of all time.
There's a few things in Judaism that are like, they're called like looked down upon, but they're not like outlawed, like playing dice.
Right.
They're like, you shouldn't, but you're allowed.
Yeah, dude. We get to go fuck hoes and shoot dice. It's hip hop. Judaism
that's
is hip hop.
We're the OGs. We're the OGs.
So I would go to New York, and like when my dad kind of, like I said, he wasn't like fire and brimstone. He's more like, isn't this a great thing? And I realized in some ways it's because my dad felt sort of as like an outsider in Judaism too, in a way. He wouldn't have admitted it outright, but
why?
My dad
he
was deaf. You know that. You know that about my parents, right?
Oh, yeah, I think you said that in the thing. No, I didn't.
So
both your parents are deaf.
My whole family is deaf.
Oh, Jesus.
And so, yeah, it just gets more. Like, this is like a fucking spider web, you know? Like, you walk into it. My family, it's like you walk in and you're like, oh, this is pretty. And then you're like, oh, it's sticky. And then you keep walking and you're like, oh, I'm getting a little wrapped up here.
Wait, your dad got dumped. Your deaf father got dumped by a deaf woman.
Yeah.
Part of him must have been like, well, that's it for me. I'm not going to find anybody else if I can't.
That's funny. Well, what happened was he started looking for other deaf Jewish women, and what he found was this woman from the Satmar community. Now, normally...
Really? That's how he got into it?
That's how he got into Satmar, because we weren't Satmar Chassids. Our family background was the Skvera Chassids, but my dad, like I said, this is another web. My dad's mom, my grandmother, when my grandfather's, the guy Zaidi, the Skvera Chassid, moved from Hungary to the United States and before the Holocaust, he moved without the family. And he was just trying to save up money to bring them. But what happened was while he was away, my grandmother was like, where's my fucking dad? And she just lost all faith in Judaism. She lost all faith in humanity. And by the time he sent for her, when she arrived in New York, she was like, fuck you. Fuck all of you. And she threw on a pair of pants and became a totally secular Jewish American communist, civil rights.
Communist?
Communist. Back then, this was before the Red Scare, so this was like people were still toying with communism as an idea in America. Oh, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't like...
Were they like, it's interesting.
Let's yeah, which Jews, it. Of course, were like, this sounds great. Everybody be equal. You know, we're used to
sounds
Europe.
Sounds like a kibbutz.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that's where kibbutz came. The early Zionism is all just communist socialist.
I know there's
stuff,
a communist party in Knesset, in the
is there?
Hebrew
yeah.
Palestine, the, whatever it's called.
Don't say Palestine. No, I'm
Palestine.
Just kidding.
What is that,
kidding.
What is that thing called?
Say it, dog.
What they have?
Free Palestine.
No.
No. So she was super secular. So yeah. My dad had both upbringings. He was raised super secular, but his grandfather was unbelievably religious. Oh. And so when he split with my mom, he remarried this woman who was raised super religious, Satmar. And normally a Satmar woman would never have been allowed to marry someone like my dad, who wasn't that religious and wasn't raised in that world. But she was deaf. She had also been divorced.
Yeah.
And the fact that he was just like willing to be religious at that point was enough for them to say, go for it. And he married into that world and sort of, he was already ready for that. He was ready to get sucked into it to, you know,
yeah.
Like we said, just like my trauma when he died is like when his family unit died, he had trauma and there was all of a sudden this code for him to start living by.
Do you think the rest of the Satmar people saw his wife and said like, hey, listen, she's not going to find anybody better.
Yes.
Like this is okay.
Yes, definitely. Okay. I definitely think so.
Like Dance with Wolves when they had that white girl marry Kevin Costner.
I see you, Dances with Wolves.
I see you. I forgot about that movie.
That's a great movie.
It really was so good. It was so good.
I am not afraid of you, Dances with Wolves. And that's actually what my dad said right before he died.
I'm not afraid of Dances with Wolves.
He was on a painted horse on top of a high butte. And he looked down on me and he said, I see you, Dances with non-Jewish women.
Raised
that was me.
Spear.
That was my
Dance with non-Jewish women.
Actually, in the book I say, because I was fat when I was a kid, I said the Lakota Sioux used to call me swims with a t-shirt.
What's the name of your book?
Casher in the Rye.
Really?
Yeah, Casher. That's my last name.
K-A-S-H-E-R. Wait, is it out yet? Or when's
it's out March 28th.
Wow.
On Grand Central Publications, and you can pre-order it now, actually, on Amazon. It tells all of these stories I'm trying to tell in a much more cogent and clear way, but that was the world that I was sort of, like, I was just bopped into, and so I didn't even know anything about religious Judaism, and then I went home to visit my dad, and I was like, oh, shit, this is happening.
Why don't they give you a play-by-play or something? Let people know. It's like, this kid might not know what's happening. Take him aside and just explain everything to him.
Because the nature of these communities, with the exception of Chabad, are that they...
Yeah, Chabad reaches out to...
Right. I mean, basically what happened, and this is what Hasidic Judaism is about, so for all of your listeners that are totally baffled by those people, is like, what happened after the Holocaust and during the Holocaust was that before the Holocaust, these Hasidic Jewish groups, they were very religious, but they were much more engaged in society.
They
were both in and out of society. There was much less of a, like, those kind of Jews, this kind. They were very in the Jewish world.
Yeah.
But they were still, they would interact with Jewish non-religious people. I mean, but what happened was essentially.
Would they be part of, like, Jewish towns?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So, but essentially, with the Holocaust, like, it was such a terrible thing to try to wrap your head around societally and, obviously religiously.
Yeah.
That a lot of these groups looked at the world and said, you know what, fuck this.
Separatist.
We're out.
Yeah.
We're going to try to preserve the last little sparks of holiness that are left in the world by rejecting the world and just becoming insular. And so when a person like me would show up in a community like that, there was no mechanism at that point to like, let's reach out to him. And it's like, oh.
There was no like playbook to be like, oh, okay, this new kid.
Exactly. Like I had this this story's in the book too, is when one of the rabbis that I met in my rabbi, I guess, in Seagate, he took me on a ride, like a drive on some afternoon, and we went to the showers, and he was just roughhousing with me. But anyway, he ended up anally raping me. No, that's not the story. I like asked him.
Roughhousing is such a great term for like a little roughhousing in the shower. What do you mean? It's America, right?
You can roughhouse, can't you?
He's 10. It's a perfect time.
No, is that we went for this drive, and I like summoned all my courage, and I asked the guy, like, this is a rabbi. I was like, I just don't know if I'm going to be religious when I grow up. I don't know what to do because I have this world where I'm living in California. I'm not that religious, but I come here, and I want to be religious, but I don't. What should I do?
Yeah.
And the rabbi was just like, I don't know. Like, it was so outside. He had no answer for me.
He's never been posed that question before.
Right.
So
it was such a rudimentary question. You would think a rabbi, that's the rabbi's job. It's not that rabbi's job.
Right.
That rabbi's job is to answer a question like, so it's my house. I have a candle on in my house, and Shabbat's coming in. And as I blow the candle out, it becomes Shabbat. But then the candle miraculously roars back into flame, and it's going to burn my house down. Do I blow it down? Do I, like, and he would be like, oh, here's what you do. You got to go find a non-Jew, tempt him into your house.
He's
with
a specialist.
Carrot. Yeah, exactly. So much so that he just didn't have an answer. He wasn't like, you're a sinner. He was just like, go to Chabad. He, like, referred me to Chabad to ask that question. And then by that point, I was just like, fuck it. I think I'll just go smoke weed instead.
How old were you when you started doing that?
12.
Jesus Christ, Moshe. 12 years old?
Yeah, and then I was like,
how did you find pot?
I mean, I was from Oakland, so it was everywhere, man. But it was cool because I finally, you know, I said, like, I just keep quoting the book. I'm sorry. This is obnoxious. Because it's all related. It's like, you know, I realized at a certain point that all of those, you know, questions I was looking to get answered by that God and the burning bush was actually waiting for me in a real bush in Northern California waiting for me to burn it, you know. And so I got back to Oakland and just sort of checked out. You know, I had this like sort of, you know, that I just all of those questions. I mean, in the same, I guess in a very similar way, I was so sort of confused and baffled that like what my dad found in Judaism, I found in drugs. Booze. I was like, oh,
drugs
here's the answer. Drugs are great.
Yeah.
Drugs are really great.
Just some people take them a little too much a lot too much, I guess.
I mean, it is very similar to religion, right? I mean,
oh, yeah.
Religion can give you a whole lot of mind expansion,
you can like dive straight into it and like way too hard.
Exactly. And lose who you are and become just a kind of zombie.
People sometimes are super religious in Judaism, forget like the reason these laws are around and the Torah is around is to help guide you with your regular life.
Right.
To help live religiously in a normal way.
Right, but that's been lost. I mean, I think this is an interesting sort of metaphor, actually, drugs and religion, because the truth is a lot of people's critique of religion is that it's not real. It's not true. But it's like, the truth is, drugs aren't real either. They're making false realities.
Yeah.
And you're getting something out of it. You're getting
an
experience.
You feel good based on something that's not even
really
there.
Yeah, but you're also having a mind expansion. Even though the thing isn't, even though the real revelations you're having aren't real, the fact that you're feeling revelations, those are real. And religion is the same thing. Like, I don't know if those myths are true or not. I mean, I have my suspicions that they're not, but that doesn't matter.
You're positive they're not true. It's okay.
Yeah, but people are still having genuine mind expansive and heart expanding. Like,
I was talking about these people
experiences.
That do the what are they called? Charismatic people that get their bodies taken over.
Oh,
by
the Pentecostals.
Yeah.
Pentecostal Christians. Yeah.
Like Pete Holmes grew up with those people. But are they just faking or are they just really into it?
I don't think they're faking. You go to Africa and those people that that jump up and down, you know, the Maasai people, they're like, they just jump until they get into a trance. It's real.
Okay.
Do you ever go to raves?
I've never been to one.
Well, I used to do that too, where I would dance and dance and dance, and I was sober at the time.
Yeah.
I would dance and dance and dance, and at a certain point, you get to this kind of body joy, this kind of ecstatic body joy.
And so that's what it is. You're so happy to be there and so into the moment.
Yeah, and also imagine it's not just body. Imagine you believe that there are spirits out there that can inhabit your body, and you're dancing and you're moving your body to this place of, I don't, have you ever done yoga?
Speaking in tongues?
Have you ever done yoga?
Uh-huh.
Or have you ever gone for a really long run? Have you ever felt emotional in any of those things?
I've gone for long runs. What do you mean?
Have they ever made you feel like emotional or like close to tears? Because I have.
I don't know.
I've gone for a run, and by the end of the run, I'm like sometimes I listen to the Moth podcast or to like short stories that are like PRI has this great podcast called Selected Shorts. It's not as good as this one, but like, and some of these stories are so beautiful, and I'm so emotionally vulnerable, become physically emotionally vulnerable that like they'll make me like feel like crying. Or when I do yoga and I do, there are two particular poses that have to do with your hips, like pigeon.
Yeah.
I've noticed like, whoa, I feel like
I've done
crying
a couple times. Really?
So it's like, I can see that. You know, you're moving your body into this.
And speaking in tongues and shaking on the ground?
Well, I mean, it's like psychosomatic. It's like, you know, I mean, it's both things. It's both real and fake.
Do you think people look over those people that are getting inhabited or whatever it is? Do you think there's some people in the congregation like, oh, yeah, Margaret again?
that's totally true.
That has to happen, right?
Yeah, because I know for sure because there's a certain later in life I got sort of my other side of my family, my father's sister, she moved to this sort of hippie, Jewish hippie commune in Israel. Do you know the Shlomo Carlbach people? Do you know there?
Yeah, Rav Shlomo. I've davened at those shuls a lot.
Okay, so I would go
there.
They're
all people who have like come back to faith, and they're super into it, but in a nice way.
Yeah, they're
those
very
don't bother
sweet.
Me at all.
Well, the only thing that bothers me is when I look over during prayer and I notice them like outwardly, demonstratively like, oh, they're just you can see that they're just like, oh, they're trying to look so holy.
Yeah.
And so I've been like, okay, it's spiritually destructive for me to look at other people praying because I'll just go like, get the fuck out of here. Just fuck yourself. But you know what? Maybe the fakeness is how they get there. However you get there.
You ever do that in acting class where the guy's like, just go overboard and then we'll see where
it takes you. It's like Adam Sandler from his comedy. Did you hear his first CD?
I'm only a fan of him from Jack and Jill. So
literally never been said before.
His first CD was awesome. It was amazing.
Remember that guy? That guy that's like, "Whoa, I'm so high. I smoked like so much weed." And then you're like, they were like, "No, that was just pencil shavings in a bag." Oh, well, it was this acid that I took.
And like,
it's like, nope, that was paper that we ripped up and threw in a bag. It's like,
yeah,
that,
people
want to
feel it, and they sort of do.
Yeah. So however you get there, because I know for sure when I went to raves, I would, like I said, I was sober. I was high. Like super ecstasy contact high, like for sure. I was just all in the ecstasy pit.
Contact high. That's
why I don't
just
know
being
was,
around
what,
them. Those definitely
I'm sure
no
they were more
high.
Genuinely high than I was, but I was definitely blissed out. I'd be in the ecstasy pit, like rubbing people in a sincere way.
Wow, and not on anything.
Not on anything. But I was young, you know, and I was reliving
you
a childhood.
You kept going
to
raves even after you stopped doing drugs.
I started going to raves after I stopped doing drugs.
Weird.
Very weird. Except for me, it was very healing. It's like, you know, I had this horrible, violent, fucked up childhood, and then when I got sober I started going to raves, which are like this by definition this sort of fake second childhood for these people, and everybody's acting like a bunch of kids, you know, they're all have pacifiers, they're all loving each other, and it's super gay and ridiculous, but for me it was like super healing, kind of.
Yeah I could see that being healing. I could see it being weird, like, oh, am I allowed to do this stuff without drugs? Am I even going to be accepted into these places?
Yeah, I don't know. I was such an anomaly that they just sort of let me in.
You weren't just like a little fuck up too. Like, I'm assuming, like, if anyone went to rehab or sobered up when they were 15 or whatever it was, I'd be like, in my community, I'd be like, oh, he got onto OxyContin, we had to clean him up.
Well, yeah.
But you were like a drug addict.
Well, I mean, OxyContin is as hard, I mean, it's much more hardcore than the drugs I was doing.
You did drug addict behavior.
Yeah, definitely. I wasn't a junkie, like, I wasn't shooting dope, but I was definitely like, as outwardly destructive behavior-wise as you can be.
You rob people?
Sure.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's like you're a drug addict.
Yeah, drug addict, yeah. And if by people you mean my mother and grandmother.
You stole from them?
A lot.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's all bad, dude. I mean, I definitely lost who I was, you know, and in a weird way, like, I had my own sort of father-like crisis where, you know, because that's the thing about drugs. When you're a drug addict, this is my sort of theory about drug addiction is that really it's not actually about if you did the most hardcore drug in the world or not. It's really about what doing drugs does for you.
Yeah.
And so if you are a person who's only kind of back to the religion metaphor, if the only thing that's ever given you a reason for living is drugs. That's drug addiction.
Right, that's a problem.
And when you get, because what happens with drugs is that there's diminishing returns on them.
Yeah,
know?
And if it's only for the religion, it's sort of the same thing. Right?
Yeah, so. I guess that's true. Although I sort of feel like you can lose yourself in religion more permanently. But what happens with drugs is that eventually.
It has a toll on your body.
Yeah. It has a toll on your body and on your mental health. And eventually, if you don't find a way to do them in a recreational way, they will lose their ability to give you that comfort that you need.
Yeah.
And so.
All my cokehead friends sort of all say the same thing, like, it doesn't do it for me anymore, but I just keep doing it. They're all like, it's a terrible drug.
Why? I have this metaphor that, like, basically what – the problem isn't the drug. The problem is the wound, right?
Uh-huh.
Like, and the wound is life, right? And so drugs – if you're a drug addict or whatever it means to be a drug addict, but if you're is that what I think it is when you take drugs, whatever drug you're taking, it makes you not feel the wound, which is whatever your wound is, whatever you bring. So you take the drugs, you don't feel the wound, so you're able to like continue to walk through the world. And of course, you know, but when you have a wound, you're supposed to be like correcting for it and limping and wincing. But when you take a painkiller, You know, and it just realize
covers it up.
It covers it up. So you're walking upright and your wound is actually not being taken care of. So it's ripping open further. So, of course, you have to take more of the drugs.
I know
so
I've done that. I'd like bad breakups. I'd be like, I'm going to get drunk. I can't feel this right now.
Exactly.
I gotta get drunk.
It's not that it makes the trauma of your breakup better. It's just that you don't feel it.
Just
so you're checked
it
out.
Well. Yeah.
So you take, but of course, your wound is getting ripped open further and further because you're not really dealing with it. So you just keep taking, shoveling more and more of the drug in. And then eventually comes a point where the balance tips. And you can't take enough of the drug to, because your wound, this wound is ripped open so much, you can't take enough of the drug to not feel the wound. But of course, you say, well, I can't stop taking drugs because look at how much pain I'm in now. If I took away my painkiller, I would just be destroyed by this pain.
And it's going to be bad when you stop.
And it's going to, and it's not, there's no like sugarcoating to the metaphor. If you do stop taking it, then you just feel the full repose of the wound. But of course, what you need to do is it has nothing to do with drugs. What you need to do is heal the wound.
Yeah. And they should have that Shiva process of where you sit and go ahead. When they sit and redo you sit and mourn and stuff, they should have that for breakups. They should be allowed to have a rule you broke up, sit and take it for a week, have everyone talk about it.
Interesting.
Don't shy away from it.
What
and
a cool
after a
idea
month, you should call her. Just let her know I'm happy you're doing okay.
That's such an interesting idea.
It would be way easier to heal.
Totally. And then also you're not allowed to talk about it anymore.
Yeah, after that.
All your friends are like, oh, dude, you know what? I would love to hear about how special she was to you, but...
Do you ever have a friend that breaks up and you're like, I'll listen to you, but after like a week, then you're like, hey, dude, now you're boring me.
Yeah.
Because your feelings are the same as everyone.
Yeah,
so just stop.
Yeah, though that's the whole nature of love. Love is this kind of great psychedelic illusion that you're playing on yourself. Like, you're like, everything is hyper real.
You guys don't understand. Like,
listen to what she said to me. She said, I like the way you smile. Can you believe it? Yeah, we all believe it. That's not
a special
thing.
I'll play along for like a day or two. I'm like, oh, it sounds awesome. And then you're like, we've been through this, man.
That's why I've lost all compassion for people that are in breakups. I feel bad that my friends have pain.
Yeah.
But I'm like...
But it's like, been there.
Yeah. Every relationship ends like this. Then you go to another one.
You'll be there again.
Yep. And then eventually you either get married or you don't. Yeah. And even when you get married, that one sometimes breaks up too. So I don't know what to tell you, dude.
The best case scenario, you get married and somebody dies.
Yeah. No, the best case scenario is you get married. You stay in love for the rest of your life.
Did Louis C.K. do a bit about like that? Something like that?
Does he?
I think something like that, where it's like maybe it's like best case scenario, you live until you hope to like die before the other person.
That's funny. Yeah, no, the best case scenario is you fall in love, you never fall out of love, and then right when you guys are like 80, you get into a train accident and both of you
together.
Die instantly.
Yeah.
And then you go to heaven and you have wings and you fly around and eat watermelon and stuff.
So let's take it back to I'm trying to go back to the topic, but I don't know how we got so far off.
No, I think we're on topic.
This shirt, by the way, is perfect for any mention of the Holocaust.
Oh, I'm wearing this very Holocaustic shirt.
Yeah, you look like a...
Also, we're totally in the dark in my apartment because my power's out.
This is the great power outage of 2011.
It affected... people will talk about this in 50 years. It affected nearly 20 blocks of Los Angeles.
There were some heavy winds.
Yeah.
That's our major weather we got.
That's why I'm wearing this Holocaust shirt in mourning of the power that's been lost.
Yeah, everything's off here. It's really
creepy.
Weird. I pulled into drive-thru and they were like, sorry.
Really?
Yeah, I think it was like Burger King or something like that.
Man, I'm more sad about the fact that you pulled into the drive-thru.
Yeah. Well, I needed something to eat and I have a date tonight. I've got to eat dinner. So I was like,
wait, you're taking a date out to dinner?
Yeah.
So you ate Burger King before? Is that like jerking off before you go
I
out
ate,
on
like,
a date?
Small. It wasn't Burger King. We weren't open. I just want to. Yeah. If
I don't think you gave enough deference
out to
my joke there.
I wasn't hearing it, but then I heard it afterwards. Yeah. Yes, it is like jerking off a little bit. I miss jokes sometimes when I'm already thinking the next thing. And I'm like,
totally.
And they're like, wait, what'd you say? That guy was hilarious.
So that's what happened was I would go back home and I would try to engage with this. It wasn't an engageable Judaism. It was like being retarded and then going home to like your, theoretical particle physics professor and father and then joining the theoretical particle physics community and you'd be like, what are you guys talking about? And then you'd be like I remember when
you
I
you get
first,
back home back to Oakland, you're like,
fuck yeah. Like when I first went to Israel to that like Karlbach thing and saw people dancing around and like dancing.
How long were you in Israel for?
I've been there a bunch, 11 times or something. But when I first, I was like blown away. I was like, oh, these people are like enjoying this?
Yeah.
Like you can do that? Like I just didn't have a real concept. So what's weird about me is all of that, everything. But one of the things that's weird about my Judaism experience is that I both have a unbelievably high high level of
knowledge,
understanding,
yeah,
and an unbelievably low level of understanding. Like I couldn't. Meanwhile, I knew what, you know, like the Midrash was, and
yeah, you know all
Yiddish,
these laws
blah, blah, blah,
you picked it all up,
and how to look like I couldn't read Hebrew. So it's like all of these things were happening at once. Like a Reformed Jew who went to summer camp every summer and had a real Jewish life, in some ways had a much more Jewish upbringing than me.
You speak Yiddish?
Oh, no, no.
So you picked the stuff up just from classes and stuff, but you never picked up the Hebrew?
No. I mean, yeah, no. I was just there 6 weeks a year. All I was concerned with was looking like I knew what I was doing, you know?
That's so weird.
It was fucking weird.
Man. And then you go back and you'd be a completely normal kid.
I would just be a normal, yeah. It was such a bizarre experience, man. I certainly wouldn't. I'm glad for
recommend it.
I wouldn't. I mean, it's just weird. I mean, I've never met anyone.
You
that
never
had
learned how to read Hebrew?
Yeah, I can read Hebrew now. I can do that now. But sort of. Yeah. Did you? My I can't even explain what just happened. That's my landlord-ish.
Oh, she just sort of stopped and
yeah.
Stared through the window.
Yeah, and she was like, "Where?" My landlord just walked out, and she was like, in like sackcloth, and like
some sort of
like this is a lot of Holocaust themed stuff happening right now.
Stared into the Jews. Look at them talking
she's
like
Jew.
They belong.
She's a Jew herself. She's my landlord. How could she not be? They're all Jews.
Is that true?
All landlords are Jews.
Because
yeah,
they own. Yeah,
in some weird way. Yeah, all landlords are Jews.
There was something I was going to ask you, but I forgot. Did you resent your father for making you do this stuff?
I just didn't have enough perspective to be able to resent him for it. You know, when I was a kid, I wanted to be two things when I grew up.
Yeah.
A Rebbe.
Yeah.
A rabbi or a baseball player.
One or the other. Or
yeah,
maybe both.
And neither of them did I actually want to be. You know what I mean? They just filled in some deficit I imagine I had, right? Like baseball for my manhood, rabbi for my soul. You know, like,
right.
But it's like
I'm somehow like, okay.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't care about sports. And I don't care about that much about, I mean, I do still have a great deal of affection and love for Judaism and religious Judaism. I'm not, I know that you've had the milk soured for you, and the milk was sour from the beginning for me, I feel like, so I got to experience it on a different level. I already knew that it was unpalatable for me, so I just like it what it is, you know?
The milk didn't even sour on me. It was just like, I don't believe in this, so I should stop doing these laws that I don't need to.
That's real.
Yeah.
What about marrying a Jewish woman? Do you care at all?
The only care in me at all is that my parents would be less upset by it.
Uh-huh.
But that's like, if I had two chicks that were equally as perfect and they
you
both wanted to marry me
and
I wanted to get married,
right?
then yeah, I would take the Jewish one.
For me, it's like I can't – I keep trying to shake that.
Shake what?
That idea that that's important.
You still feel like it is?
I mean, I know it's not.
Yeah,
on a top level of my brain. I know that it's not, and yet I can't truly shake it.
I have a lot of stuff like that in my life where I feel like, I know, if I think this out, I know this is not the case.
Yeah,
and yet, I still feel.
Right, like, you know, like, I know that eating pussy is for suckers, right?
Yeah.
But I can't stop doing it, son. It tastes so good.
What's up? yeah, so you're going to marry, you want to marry Jewish?
I don't
Do you date
know.
Jewish girls ever?
Sometimes. At an equal proportion of every other woman that I date.
At a 4% rate or whatever they
are
here. Yeah,
whatever
in
amount. Yeah, whatever. I mean, that's not true because I mostly date white girls, right? So, you know, half of the white girls are Jews.
I found for a while that I was, yeah, that's true.
For a while,
I was like actively turned off by the look of a Jewish woman.
Oh, I luckily am not. Okay. Like, I'm so attracted to the Jewish look. Like, I've got a boner right now.
Just
that you're here. All right. Like, basically. No, I am. I think they're really hot. I think they
I like
got,
how you looked up at me as you said that.
Even though we're in the dark, actually. We're recording in the dark right now. No, but I like the Jewish look. I like big noses. I like big butts.
Really?
Yeah.
I've gotten into big butts lately. And chubbier girls a little bit once
best.
In a while.
Nothing better. I like big butts, and honestly, I cannot lie.
Yeah,
other brothers
have to tell the truth.
You know, other brothers can't deny. Anyway, yeah, no, I'm. I think that's the Oakland in me, not the Jew in me, that likes big butts. But it just happens to.
Did you grow up in a safe part of Oakland?
What's that?
Were you in the safe part of Oakland?
I wasn't raised in the hood. There are some really terrible ghetto parts of Oakland, but you know, Oakland in general was a little grimy growing up.
It seems nice. I went to that one part.
Yeah, it is nice.
It was like
it's both nice and not nice. It's like Silver Lake. Yeah,
parts of it were like, or like Larchmont, where it's like sort of rich.
Yeah,
only
totally.
White people were there.
Rock Ridge is where you were.
So then how old were you when Dad died?
I was 20.
Did you the Shiva and stuff?
I did, yeah.
Out of respect for him?
Yeah, I mean.
Or were you feeling
out of respect for myself,
I should do this.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It wasn't like some burden. It was like, I didn't want to, I wasn't like, oh God, I wish I could be doing sets back in San Francisco. I want to do.
Yeah, weird. Even though I know that, we just talked about how helpful that is, that Shiva situation.
It sounds terrible to you?
No, I don't think I would do it.
You wouldn't do it?
No.
Interesting.
But maybe I should.
I mean, I don't know. Why wouldn't you?
I don't know. Because I know the same thing. I know this is probably helpful.
What would you do? Oh, maybe you just
keep
go
going
home
out
and
just cry out in public. And
right, know. Right. Or try not to cry in public.
Yeah.
Just get high and forget about it.
It's great being alone in your house. You can just let loose.
Yeah,
let the tears just
you live
go.
Alone?
Yeah.
Yeah, man. It's the best.
I've had girls live with me before.
I've never had that.
Have a girl live with you?
No. Is it cool?
It's cool because they clean up.
Right.
They like the thing they care about. You're sort of like me where it's like it's tidy-ish in here. Yeah. It's not disgusting. There's no food items out.
All right.
But it's cluttered.
Yeah, totally. They take care
of
that.
And girls won't allow that. And they'll just do it. They'll just do it.
Oof, I like that a lot.
Everything. Do you want this lamp over here or over there? And you're like, I don't care at all.
Why? What do you mean? It's a lamp.
This will open up whatever you want to do.
So I guess if there's a girl listening right now, Jewish girl, big butt, street smart.
Cash is looking for a short-term relationship.
Down to clean up a bit. yeah, I'm down.
I'm trying to think what else I wanted to ask you about this topic, but we didn't really get into anything.
Oh,
so
Judaism?
Sidetracked over and over again. Yeah, maybe.
You think this wasn't interesting?
It was interesting as shit. I'm really bad at sticking to topics. I usually think one up, and then we like deal with it for like 15 minutes out of an hour.
I mean, I can talk. Oh, well, what I was going to tell you was that yesterday I was telling the story of when my brother went to.
Oh, yeah.
So when my dad died, my brother got really started. He didn't get enough out of the Shiva thing, so he was like, he needed more. So he jumped into religious Judaism.
Jeez.
And he, like I said, he got his rabbinate from a really sort of liberal branch of the Orthodox movement, but where he started was a much more conservative, hardcore yeshiva in Israel that dealt with people like him, basically.
Which one did he go to?
It was called...
Neve?
No, it was called Machon Shlomo, but it's equal to Neve or Eish HaTorah.
Eish
HaTorah.
All these fuck ups and drug addicts would come to Israel and find a religious experience, and they cater to them. You know, they would have like play your music, do whatever you want.
Right, and then eventually the kind of the
after like a year or two, like maybe
the handcuffs
you shouldn't be listening to that music.
They just click click click, and then eventually what they're doing, they're trying to churn out religious Jews. Eish HaTorah is the big kind of monolith of that. And Machon Shlomo is a very small, very specified...
But same version?
Same kind of thing, except it's very specific for very specific intellectual groups.
Instead of Two Live Crew, here's some Mordechai Ben David.
Yeah, well, Mordechai Ben David, as you know,
I forgot.
My mortal enemy.
I forgot about that.
But
I forgot that was who it was.
Yeah. So,
is that in your book?
Yeah, that's in my book.
That's
so there's great. A part of my book where I said... Because I'll tell the story before we end. But.
I want to, I'm starting to podcast. Maren convinced me to podcast these storyteller shows, and
that story
that you told about this stuff was we didn't record it. I'm like, motherfucker.
Right. Well,
it
we'll do
be
it
out,
again.
But at least you wrote it in the book. Go ahead.
Yeah. So David went to this place called Machon Shlomo, which is very specific. It's like mostly Ivy League kids would go there.
Uh-oh.
So it was for smart kids.
Smarter kids. Okay.
And David was reading The Lord of the Rings while he was there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just because. And
sure,
he got into this conversation with this guy who was like, why are you reading The Lord of the Rings? And David was like, I don't know. What do you mean? I'm just reading it. And he's like,
work of art.
Why would I want to read another man's lies?
What?
It wasn't even like it's sacrilegious to read that. It was like, why would you read fiction that isn't written by God? It's just... just some story, like basically
don't do anything
but study religion, ever, always, forever.
Yeah, if you're not going up, you're going down.
Yeah, and it's just like...
So it's like, don't even... Wow.
Nothing. Don't do anything.
He couldn't even wrap his head around it. Like, why would you do that?
Yeah, don't read books. That was his message. Don't read... Don't read those books. There's no point in reading fiction. And again, I want to stress,
lies.
It's not because he thought... that The Lord of the Rings was filled with
evil or anything.
Evil imagery. It was just like, it's stupid and pointless and evil to read fiction. It's fiction. Read the Bible. Forgetting your beliefs that the Bible is fictitious. I'm just saying, in that guy's mind,
that
it was
is
like,
real. And so it's like, yeah, dude. Oh my gosh.
So
how long did he stay there for?
He was there for like a year and a half, and I went and visited him there, and it was the most horrible. I mean, it was oppressive. I just couldn't believe it. I remember thinking, he just has to get out of here, or I'm going to lose him.
Oh yeah, people definitely get lost to that.
Yeah,
but when they come back to America, usually the religion goes down a little
bit. Yeah, exactly. So he came. He mellowed out. You know, my brother is my brother after all. So he's not an idiot. And he on Christmas. He was running through the halls of Machon Shlomo singing Christmas carols, and they really hated that. They were really not into that. And then he eventually left and went to a really kind of mellow. Now he's like the rabbi at.
Oh, he still stayed in religion.
Yeah, he's a rabbi, and he's at UC Berkeley's Hillel, and
really?
He's very mellow. And he's
what
also
think
getting,
about you
getting
Hillel's
a PhD.
Pretty like it's
oh,
cool.
He,
if you're not
oh,
religious,
he's
do what
David's
you can.
Very into what I do. Actually, he helps me. He was one of the main people that helped me edit the book. So he's got a great sense of humor. He's getting a PhD in UC Berkeley Law School. So he's like he's pretty regular now. But at but you know what I'm saying is he'll read The Lord of the Rings.
Right now, I guess we'll finally finish it up.
Yeah,
it's like there's three books and everything.
Yeah,
they fuck. What was I just gonna say? God damn it! It's just darkness. Storm me up.
It is That's really creepy. What's happening right now?
Maybe we should. I want to say one more thing.
No, keep talking. I don't need. What do you got?
Nothing. What is it at? 57?
Oh, yeah. We've been talking an hour, dude. This is the best.
That's not bad. Casher and the Rye. It's so cool that you're doing that, by the way, that you actually wrote a book. How long did it take you?
Yeah, it took me a year and a half or something like that.
And they're all just stories?
It's a novel. Or not a novel. I mean, it's a memoir. It's a full narrative kind of memoir. Like, it starts one place and goes till the end, and... I'm pretty damn proud of it, man. I gotta say I am. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Everybody thinks of writing a book,
right?
Like everybody, but no one's done it.
Well, what's interesting is if you had come up to me when I was a kid, you know, between all this and all the cobwebs, and you'd said, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" I never would have said I want to be a stand-up comic,
right?
But I would have said I want to be a writer. So yeah, I wanted to write books when I was a little kid, and so it's the fact that it happened is pretty damn cool.
Yeah. And so who's putting it out?
Grand Central. Is putting it out. They put out like Stephen Colbert's book and Chelsea Handler's books and stuff.
Oh wow!
So I'm probably the smallest creature they have
in there.
Yeah,
that's really cool that you did that.
Yeah, man. Definitely. It's an exciting.
And so your brother stayed with it. You left. Your mom. You still talk to her?
I still talk to my sure. Yeah. I mean, I didn't leave it. You know, I don't eat pork for a reason.
Really. You still don't?
I don't eat pork.
But
no.
What are you doing? Isn't it part of you is like do it all or do nothing? Like, why aren't you eating?
No,
pork?
No, I don't. I've never been a victim of that kind of belief system, but I understand what you're saying. Like what we were talking about earlier is that Hasidic Judaism, you know, more than even Christianity in some ways, because there's so many rules, Hasidic Judaism or Haredi Orthodox Judaism, there are 613 laws. The 613, you wonder how many laws is that? That's exactly enough laws to govern every part of your life.
Day.
Yeah. Yeah, like there is nothing that you do that isn't connected to one of these laws. And so, you know, if you're a person that needs a way
to live,
there's
like a bunch of these things you should do, and there's a bunch of stuff you shouldn't do.
Exactly, and
like
it's
don't kill, do give charity,
right? Go pee, say a blessing after you pee. I mean, it's like it's a very systematized kind of way of life, and I relate to it. Like when I've been in Israel, like
I used to say that prayer after you go to the bathroom.
Yeah, yeah, man.
I forget it now, but it was like, thanks God for letting me for your design not being completely flawed,
right,
and allowing my shit to come out of me instead of build up inside me.
There's something to that.
I guess. I think most of it's just like, remember God in all moments of your life.
Yeah, totally. And it's like, I relate to it. Like, it's not just that I've been tempted by the idea. It's that I feel fiercely jealous of the people
Who were super into it.
Yeah. It's
yeah,
like,
I'm a little jealous of them too.
I would love to be able to dive into that pool.
The sense of
just,
community they have.
The sense of community.
I only get that a little bit with the comedy store, with comedy in general, but just a little bit. Not like it was with a religious community.
Exactly. And you know what to do. You know what the answers are. There's no ambiguity about what is the right thing to do, what isn't the right thing to do. There's no ambiguity.
Do you ever have any question at all?
Yeah.
It's just a question of like, it's just... just ask the one guy who can tell you one way or the other.
Right.
You know?
It's very simple. And if you went to those people, because look, the big fallacy is that religious people are stupid. That's straight up bullshit. The religious people I know, most of them are highly intelligent and highly educated.
Why do people call them stupid? Because they believe
A thing that someone else has judged to be silly or fictitious.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, what we all believe in things that are not, that are arguable. And
yeah,
all of our beliefs. And if you start, you know, it's just, I'm not saying that.
I sort of believe you can't ask a girl for a blowjob. You can't be like, hey, suck my dick. Like, I've never been able to say
what
that.
What do you say?
I just sort of.
You just put it in her mouth.
And push or.
In her motherfucking mouth.
If they're like, is there anything I can do for you?
You
like,
kind of
yeah,
go.
Maybe.
You just go, well.
I just feel like they should
hope for
do
the
it.
Best. Yeah.
But that's not smart.
Right.
You
right.
know? But I'm smart in other parts of my life.
Yeah,
so part of me has this belief that I can't shake.
No, but what I'm saying is even more than that is like a lot of religious people, even though let's say religion.
Yeah, they go to Harvard and they're doctors.
Yeah, but let's say religion is bullshit.
Okay.
Fine. Let's start with that.
On the record, Moshe Kasher said religion is bullshit. Yes.
These are people that are studying this bullshit for
12
hours a day. These are not dumb people. These are
being an Orthodox Jew and studying in yeshiva has told more to my stand-up comedy, just my sense of logic and how much all of Talmud is just logic.
Yeah, right.
Like, why would this be the case?
That's so interesting.
So, that's just how I break down stuff on stage, too. It's
right.
Let's just make it a logical answer to stuff.
And these people are brilliant. They might be studying a thing that you find unimportant or fake, but these people are brilliant. The truth is it's no less intellectually engaging than studying fiction in an English department.
Right.
You know, I mean, those people are not
same
less
interesting.
Yeah. So these people are intelligent people. And they, you know, they might believe a thing that you think is a lie, but they're intelligent people and they're engaged in a thing that is this weird kind of like system of living. And like, you know, I don't know about you, but I sometimes totally feel like I could use a system of living. It would definitely help.
This is what I think. I think the reason God was made was because life sucks and just to have to die and do nothing afterwards is really scary.
Sure. That's
true. And so
true.
It's like it's an easier life.
Well, then why is Judaism a religion that isn't that concerned with afterlife? I mean, the truth is...
Because everybody goes.
What's that?
Everybody goes.
Everybody gets to go, so it doesn't matter?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it matters, but it's like you try to be a good person on Earth, and then he'll take care of it later. Everyone does their 11 months of purgatory.
Right, but it's just like, I don't know, I've always thought... Like, what I'm saying is that I reject the idea that the exclusive reason for people to have come up with a God figure and to come up with a spiritual or religious life is exclusively for the afterlife part. I'm not doubting that that's part of it, but that discounts, like, the nourishment that your psyche gets from being a religious person in this life. Like, Buddhists don't...
Well, you say it's for the afterlife so that you'll feel better in this life. I can't toil in the fields all day long.
No, but I'm saying like you get peace and comfort from prayer, and you get peace of mind from intellectual engagement with this or meditation. You know, people that meditate are like, you know, they some percentage happier than people that don't in the world. So it's like
there is something they said to like Friday night and Saturday, the Shabbat, not doing anything.
Yeah,
it is like a resetting.
Totally,
it's like you can't drive, you can't do anything, so just sit there, either read a novel or do something. Right. Just calm down.
You know that bumper sticker that says the union from the people that brought you the weekend. It's not true. The Jews brought you the weekend.
That's right.
The idea of Shabbat when the Romans came into Israel and were conquering the ancient Hebrews, they were like absolutely baffled by the idea that these Jews didn't work on one day of the week. They were like, why are these lazy Jews just sitting around?
When I lived in Israel, in yeshiva and stuff, Friday was to go visit like your family or something, or someone else. Like, you have to go or do your shopping.
Right, and then go home and chill for 24 hours. Yeah. There's something really powerful about that. Like, I mean, imagine if you got married or I got married. Let's taking the God thing out of it. Like, if I got married and once a week, on Friday night, I sat down with my family, had dinner, and then Saturday, I spent the entire day with my family. And
that's the reason I think so few Jews are complete fuck-ups like you were.
Yeah.
And you know I'm just joking around with you.
No, that's fine. But I was trying to think if I think that's true. Because
you're there on, not all Jews, but religious Jews. You're there Friday night with your kid.
Right.
Like, can they really become a meth head if you see them and talk to them every Friday night?
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. Yeah, and my brother actually
I mean, how much can you can't lose track of them completely.
Right. My brother actually has this really interesting idea about Nida, or the one of the more controversial parts of religious Judaism, which is
this is why non-Jews are allowed to be fucked. But go ahead.
Okay. So it's about the women's periods.
Yeah.
Which are, you know, what's interesting is I studied religion in college. Every religion that I so far as I can tell that I have studied so far has had a has been conflicted by the meaning of a woman's period. Like, for some reason, every religion feels the need to engage with that spiritually.
Yeah, Jews say you're unclean.
Just, the Jews say you're unclean and that you need to get purified. I mean, unclean would be, well, what the point is,
You can't sleep in the same bed as your husband.
Right. It's a whole thing. It's very controversial, and a lot of people really hate it. You certainly can't have sex with your husband while you're on.
But that's why non-Jews, the laws of periods don't apply to them.
Oh, that's
so they're never unclean.
Uh-huh. So, my brother's idea is that, yeah, it sounds really archaic and weird, definitely, to say don't fuck your wife like a week before, like during the week after. Was it after or before?
It's 7 days after the last drop of blood she's had.
So it's intense.
7 clean days, then take a ritual bath.
Right.
Get
that's really intense. But
yeah,
every couple in the world suffers from this this lust.
Keeps you fresh.
Yeah, exactly. This
I remember those laws, and I was like, one, it keeps you fresh. Like after, let's say you bleed for 3 days, then 7 clean days, then you visit it. So you're talking about 11 days.
Yeah.
Of not, even if you only bleed for 3 days. Of not fucking. When those 11 days are up, you're like, get in the fucking house.
Exactly. So how many married couples 20 years in are having moments where they're like, oh, I want you so bad right now?
Yeah, not many, because it's always available.
It's always
there.
When
it's not always available, it's way more sought after.
Yeah, so maybe that keeps the
also, after those 7 days is usually around when you're the most fertile.
Oh, interesting.
So they're like, you're the most horny when you're the most ready to have a baby.
Yeah, right.
So it's just like.
And that's why they have so many damn kids. But anyway.
Yeah, righto.
Brido? Is that what you said?
Yeah, just
me too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't know why this is throwing a party. Hopefully this gets edited out. I have a feeling you don't edit very much.
I don't edit almost at all. If I said something really bad, if I had mentioned you cheated on your girlfriend, I was like, God damn it, I forgot you were still dating her.
Or something like that.
Then I'd be like, okay, I'll figure that out. But that's it.
Yeah. So I don't have a particularly antagonistic relationship towards religion. In fact, one of my most famous bits is that heaven and hell bit. Have you seen that?
I don't know.
It's
this
bit about going to heaven. Basically, it's a long bit.
I like bits about.
But it's how hell sound is so intricately described by religion, but heaven is really
barely ever. Yeah, you're right.
So it's like why don't they tell me what prizes I'm going to win when I get to heaven? And can you imagine how awful it would be if
positive reinforcement?
Yeah, exactly. The carrot to draw you towards. So can you, the whole bit, it's a long bit, but, can you imagine what it'd be like if you sacrifice the big things you need to sacrifice in life to get to heaven, like marijuana and anonymous blowjobs?
Yeah.
This is the joke. And you get up there, and it's exactly how they envision it for you in the cartoons. They're like, hey, welcome to heaven. Here's your harp.
I have seen this bit. It's a good bit.
Anyway, so it's a long thing. So it got on, got put on the front page of YouTube and got like, 500,000 views. And that was,
really?
That was exciting. And I was like, it's fun to watch people's response to it. A lot of people talking shit.
Fuck you, you don't know anything about God.
Yeah.
And you're like, it's a terrible joke.
And then other people claiming me as this kind of like, or the religious people and the atheist people claiming me as an atheist comic. Like, I'm not an atheist. So they'd be like, typical atheist. It's like, I'm not even, you guys are so uptight. Religious people are so uptight, they can't even hear someone poking fun at them without being like, you are a non-believer. I mean, I'm not much of a believer. I'm no Ari Shaffir, though, is what I'm saying.
I don't hate Jews and God. I just completely don't believe in it. And I'm like, there's nothing else in my life that I will accept when there's no proof for it all.
Ever again. Yeah, there's something to be
pretty
said for that.
Never again.
Do you think you're less happy because of it?
No.
No.
Maybe at first it was like conflicting and filled me with some sadness.
Right.
I couldn't eat. I ate Taco Bell. That was one of the first things I ate when I stopped eating kosher.
So sad. Yeah. That'll make you feel depressed even if it's not a religious crisis.
But then I started getting nauseous for eating Taco Bell. I don't know if it was because I felt guilty or because it's fucking Taco Bell.
Totally.
And it's 38% meat in their meat.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
That's really good, dude. I mean, like I said, that'll give you a crisis of faith with or without.
Yeah, I lived there for a long time. I really liked what I studied in yeshiva and stuff. I really liked those times. It was great.
It's nice to know when there's this. I mean, it's nice to have answers, dude. I definitely wish somebody would just tell me the right thing sometimes, and I don't know the right thing sometimes now.
My thing now is like, what would make me happiest in life? So if you start bitching at me or whatever, it's okay, I'll see you.
I'll just leave.
The answer is, I don't know. Just find whatever makes you happy and do that.
Right.
Like whatever it is.
Joseph Campbell, follow your bliss.
Maybe.
Right. You know what?
And if it makes you unhappy to see your friends unhappy, then you don't hurt them.
Right.
But if that does make you happy, then hurt away, I guess.
But and then you get down to, do no harm. But you're saying no. You're saying do harm.
I can't decide if
it's
do no harm or not. I can't decide if You should just, you're just living, this life is short and meaningless, so just enjoy yourself while you're here.
What if you like fucking babies?
Right, what if you're Uday and who's, whatever, Kusa Simpson.
Right, what if that's your thing?
Then it's, those part people of me feels exist. Like, yeah, that's, for those people, that's okay.
Well, here's my more
It's just bad around the people around them.
Right, here's my most controversial, like, idea, is that, I don't know about my most, but like the idea that like, you know, we place value on when good death is good and when death is bad, but the truth is, there's no real actual difference between a 7-year-old dying of leukemia and a 97-year-old dying of a heart attack. Like, what's the real difference is the value that you've placed on longevity of life.
The Penn State stuff and the Syracuse stuff. People are like, you don't mess with kids. We will protect our kids because they're the most victim.
Right. But they are innocent and they are kids.
But it's like, I wonder why we decided that. Like, that's going to be our line of like, you can rape a woman, that's bad. But if you rape a kid,
you
it's
should be
beyond
die.
Bad.
That's interesting. Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, that's very interesting.
I mean, I just don't know what the line
is. At first, I thought was going to disagree with you, Ari, but then I think, yeah, you're right. It's like, yeah, rape a woman. You can destroy a woman's life starting at 18. That's one thing. But if you destroy a woman's life starting at 7, you're an animal and should die.
Is it 17? Is it 16? Yeah. Like, where does it become too egregious?
Right. I guess the point here is rape.
My point is you should start raping.
I feel like
my theory on heaven and hell is that I think it's whatever you're into here. So if you're just studying Torah all day long, the afterlife for you is going to be awesome because that's what it'll be.
You don't believe
if you're doing drugs and shit, then that's what's going to happen. And they'll call that hell, but you'll be enjoying that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You say like the idea of this life being very temporal.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I've been sober now for 17 years. Since I was 15.
Yeah.
So there's a part of me that thinks, like, if life just ends.
Yeah. That's what I do believe. It just ends.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
Okay.
I do know, but I don't want to say or whatever thing. Who knows? Yeah. Probably life just ends. Like, so if life just ends, like, two things. Why be sober? Why not just be able to get high and blah, blah, blah?
Mm-hmm.
That's a thing, you know, that I think about. Like, why am I wasting my time?
That's what I did
I've done
religion.
17
like, why
years.
Why am I trying to keep kosher when I shouldn't do this?
I've done 17 years of this. It was a great idea at the time, but why not enjoy being able to smoke weed or have a glass of wine? But then there's another part of me, which is just as true.
Yeah, it is.
Which is, well, the problem is life is short and ends. And if you are still... If you do still have this affliction of addiction,
if you still have the affliction, that's the problem.
Then you will literally piss. I mean, we all like anytime
you'll
fuck
away your life.
You'll anytime I'm worried about like where my career is going or where my life is going or my lack of love in my life, I just think about like you know walking down in downtown LA and going, oh, so you just smoked crack? That's what you chose to do with your life? Just that? Just only crack?
We were in Montreal this year, doing the Nasty Show, and we all hang out. Behind that, remember Metropolis? Do you remember that room?
Which is it?
It's where Louis went up last year.
Sure,
I mean, when you were there like 2 years ago, three years ago.
Yeah, I remember.
But in the back steps, we'd all sit and smoke pot. And there was this guy, and it's sort of projecty back there.
Yeah.
And there was this guy kind of huddled over, and somebody was like talking to him, and then he left. And we were like, oh, he just smoked some crack or whatever. And then after like an hour and a half, it was me, Jeselnik, Big J Okerson, and I think Jeff Ross, and just sort of laughing at him. And then an ambulance came like an hour later. And we're like, oh. Yeah, we probably should have made a call ourselves.
Oh, my God.
We just all assumed he was fine. He was just cracked up.
Right.
But we're like, oh.
Yeah, I mean, I think about that a lot.
If you would fall back into that, that would be
way worse. I know, I
wouldn't.
I'm just – no. I don't – I. It's very difficult for me to – I don't believe that I would – it's very difficult for me to imagine that I would immediately –
Not immediately, but let's
say over a year. Or just even in general that I would become some junkie on the streets. I don't believe that's true. I mean,
so why don't you do it then, just for the risk?
Well, what I could very easily see happening to me is that I don't think I would become a junkie on the street, but I could see myself slowly becoming a habitual user and drinker and flittering my career away and flittering my relationships away and just being kind
of... Yes, there is that. There's lazy potheads.
Just being
That's a
kind
real
of, a, of a mm-hmm. habitual bum, and I don't know. I still am not willing to take the risk, I guess.
Yeah. What seems to fill you with some sort of fulfillment or joy is like
eating pussy.
There's that. But there's also like writing a book and like doing a new bit.
A book and going out on tour. It's like I just know our lifestyle, man. It's like nobody would ever tell me to slow down.
Yeah.
That's never, maybe if I was a grad school, like if I was a professor in a college and married with kids,
yeah,
maybe I'd be like, yeah, I should just start smoking weed and having some wine. But it's like, I'm not, dude. I'm a touring stand-up comedian. And it's like, on a Tuesday night at one, you know, on Thanksgiving, I saw you at the Comedy Store at like midnight. And
we were
like,
just hanging
if
out.
If I had been like, let's go drink for 4 hours, nobody would have been like, dude, come on. And you'd be like, yeah, let's fucking do
yeah,
it.
It's always around you.
And if I started to fall apart a little bit, people would be like, awesome, check yeah. it out. You know what I mean?
I used to think about Hedberg and stuff. Like, why didn't anybody get him help? I'm like, because everyone's doing drugs.
Yeah, everybody's doing drugs.
They were
drugs.
Like, we're all doing it. What do you
and
mean?
And it's helping just Hedberg look cool. You know? It's bad. That's the bad nature of this beast. But
somebody that same year in Montreal, somebody that I know from here was in the film part, and they said they saw in some older, like not older, but like a little older,
yeah,
most respected stand-up comic, and a yeah. bunch of people doing coke with him in the bathroom, and just saying like, ugh, all these comics are trying to do coke with this guy, and he was just right. like, ugh, and just turned around and left.
Yeah, that's funny, dude. I did coke with this guy.
Yeah.
Whoa,
way yeah. to go, man! You did
yeah,
it.
Congrats. I mean, I see actually. I don't know if you see this with younger comics.
What
I've seen this sort of this thing where they're trying to become like desperate alcoholics.
Oh yeah, because it's
on
cool.
stage.
It's like,
you know,
I want to be Bukowski, but it's
I
like, you're
be,
not one.
I
want
to. Yeah, they want to you know affect the kind of, you know,
yeah, they're bragging about their pain they don't really
the
have.
The nihilistic, you know, blight relationship with society that like Stanhope or Kyle Kinane
yeah.
have.
But they don't really have it. They're
they don't have it
like
yet, but
trying,
they will.
Hopefully, if they keep going.
They won't be. They might not be. They probably won't be as funny as Doug and Kyle, but they will.
Yeah.
They'll get there. I mean, you can get there, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, and the other thing is, by the way, Kyle and Stanhope are very successful, very
also,
motivated.
They work really hard.
They work
writing.
Super hard. Yeah.
yeah.
It's a flawed concept.
Stuff.
It's a flawed concept. But I hate when I see some like 24-year-old comic like, I mostly just drink, man, because life fucked. And I'm just like,
yeah,
get
like,
out of here.
You're just drinking because you're a fuck up. Like, or because you're a frat guy.
Yeah. Your angst is fake and your
yeah.
alcoholism is fake, but soon neither will be fake, but your career will be non-existent.
At some point, you'll need 5 beers before you get on stage.
Yeah.
That's
anyway.
In trouble. Do you have any closing prayers before we get out
yeah,
of here?
Yeah, in the name of...
By the way, I should mention, I interviewed Neil for this podcast too. But,
oh, did you?
Yeah, you were in the podcast with him. You're that same
yeah,
champs.
We have a... Yeah, I was going to say for the closing prayer, in the name of Allah, the beneficent, the one and only...
One and only Allah.
Muhammad is his only prophet. But speaking of black people, Neil and I have a podcast called The Champs, and DJ Doug Pound from the Tim and Eric program. It's called The Champs, and we have a rotating black guest.
Yeah, I love that idea.
It's cool, right?
I love that.
What's cool about it was that it feels a little fetishy. That's the bad part of it. But the good part of it is every week we have a guest who's basically never been approached by a podcast.
Never.
Before. Yeah.
I don't think I've had any. I wanted to interview Ian Edwards about what it's like to be black in America.
Yeah.
But he's so, like, oh, man, no.
No. So all these guys are like, literally, oh, I've never done a podcast.
Podcast?
So that's,
what is that?
That's so cool.
Yeah,
you know,
got Blake like Griffin.
All these
I heard about that stuff.
Exclusive. Yeah, we had Wayne Brady this week.
Really?
Yeah.
He barely qualifies. You must have talked about that, right?
We did. And he had a lot of really... really interesting things to say about blackness and his own relationship with it and his relationship with people's views of his blackness.
I used to think about him a lot because he was with the same management company as Rogan.
Uh-huh.
So I would like think about that guy a lot.
Right.
And be like, I know he wants his street cred that he doesn't have, but he's super talented.
He's so talented. And so
he
you hear
sing and dance and do all yeah. this crazy shit.
Yeah.
And riff. He's like a magician on stage.
Totally. He's a good dude and a funny dude. Mm-hmm. Listen to the it's a great episode, okay. actually. So we have that. And I've got the book
Catcher
coming
the
out.
Rye. I'm rereading Catcher in the Rye right now.
Oh, are you? Oh, yeah. Cool. Actually, there's this funny scene in the this kind of synchronous scene. I thought of the story before I remembered. I thought of the name before. Actually, my brother helped me think of the name, but before I remembered the story, which was in after all of my woes in school. You know, I dropped out of school in seventh grade, and then I got back in, and I dropped out again. I flunked ninth grade like 3 times.
I skipped school once, and I got in so much trouble. I was so much trouble. I was grounded for skipping school once.
I got grounded by life.
I guess you had it worse.
I didn't have it worse. I'm just saying, it's not like I avoided trouble. I was like arrested and things. So when I finally like took when I finally went to my last high school, I had just gotten sober. I was like 6 months sober, and I went to this high school for like fuck ups.
Yeah.
And the teacher there was called Sprangs Academy. The teacher there, Dr. Violet Sprangs, I wonder if she's even still alive. She looked at me and was like, "What do you want to do which is like not, I'd never really been asked that question before.
It's a weird question. It's like, what's your end goal here? What do you want? What's the actual thing you want? Like, to show them they're stupid. Like, and then what would you get out of that?
Right.
What do you want?
So I'd never really been approached like that by a teacher. It was always people telling me, here's what you have to do. And I would just be like, fuck you, man.
I don't want
to
do that. Yeah.
And
what do you want?
So
then how do we
she
get
said, well, what do you want to do? So I was like, well, I guess what I want is to, you know, get my high school, my GED, and get out of school. And she was like, I was like, I already flunked ninth grade 3 fucking times. I'm fucked. And she was like, okay, cool. And I was like, what do you mean, okay? She's like, okay, I'll help you do that. I will literally set up an entire curriculum just for you. You will sit one-on-one with a teacher all day long, and we will tutor you for the GED so that you can pass that. And I was like blown away by it. And she's like, but it's going to take me a while to get that schedule going. So what I need you to do for me to show me that you're serious about this.
Suck this sweet box.
Eat my sweet Sprang's pussy. No, is it?
Have you ever seen the thing in the back of the New Yorker? Those cartoon, and you have to write your own caption.
Yeah,
they
yeah.
They show the winning one from last week, totally. The finalist from the week before, and then a blank one. And I always just think of the most sexual, horrible thing that
you should just start sending them in every week to see if it ever
same
wins.
Thing.
No, she goes. But what I need you to do for me is to show me that you're serious. Is read just sit in my office. Until we set this up for you, and just read this book and read it and analyze it and, you know, really like seriously delve into it. And she gave me a copy of Catcher in the Rye.
Oh, wow. How old were you?
I was
10th grade? 12th grade?
I don't know, 16.
Okay.
But the point is like, so I sat there and read that book for like a month and just gonna, until they set up this curriculum for me. But it was Catcher in the Rye. My book is Catcher in the Rye. So there's this cool synchronicity in it. There's all kinds of weird synchronicity in the book. That there's all these weird kind of odd coincidences that happen.
So, I remember it being so much different than I remember when I read it in like fourth grade.
Is that right?
I just remember laughing because people farted and and like cursed. And I was like, this is an awesome. But now it's like, oh, he's such an asshole. Just constantly judging everybody. For doing the same thing that he's going to do in, like, 2 pages from now.
Totally.
Like, nearly the same exact thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a really good book. I guess that's why everyone's heard of it.
It's another really good book, similarly titled.
Catcher in the Rye.
Catcher in the Rye. And that's happening.
Pre-order now on Amazon.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're on Twitter, too, right?
Twitter, at Moshe Kasher, and, you know, on my touring schedule. And
I met you in San Francisco for the first time. That was, like, 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah, where did we meet?
It was at Cobb's, the waiting room at Cobb's.
Were you with Rogan?
I was with Rogan, yeah.
Yeah,
and
cool.
And you were friends with Tate, I guess.
Tate. Yeah. The big UFC fighter guy.
Yeah. You're like, you know, a friend of mine or something. It was, you look so goddamn young.
Yeah, well, I was, yeah.
You were like this little nerd hipster kid.
Oh, man. What do I look like now?
An adult.
A big nerd hipster kid.
Yeah.
Well, here's to growing up.
Very nice. Well, thanks for doing it, man.
Thanks, Ari.
Anything else?
I love you.
Okay. Bye. Okay. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. That was the podcast of the Great Blackout of 2011. We were, by the end of this, we were in pitch darkness. It was like we couldn't see. We had to turn on our cell phones to find anything. That's the new version of We Had It Tough in your age or whatever. Whatever your grandparents used to say to you, where it was like, you know, when I was your age, I used to have to walk 2 miles in the snow, which no one ever does, but it became a hacky joke. That's what we're going to have to do. When I was your age, I had to unlock my cell phone so we could find our keys in blackouts. And our grandkids will say, what do you mean? Why didn't you just have a reusable energy source that you could recharge constantly from solar power? And we'd be like, oh, whatever. I'm done with that. I'm done with that little aside. All right, everybody. That's it. Thank you very much for tuning in. By the way, I'm lowering my voice like nobody's going to hear me. The hunt for the edibles in Vegas went great. It wasn't great because my friend Jason Mayhem Miller lost his fight in the UFC. But it was great that we had the hunt for the edibles in his honor, and people found them. And then I got reports of somebody going to where they thought they were, and they were right. But the usher was going, hey, what you're looking for? It's not here anymore. That guy was wearing a Bert Kreischer t-shirt. It told me that. That's it. Oh, speaking of Bert Kreischer, I think we're trying to set up a tour with me, Bert, John Heffron, and John Reap. for sometime in February or March or something. I don't know, in the South, I think. We're trying to work it out, but it should be shitloads of fun if we get it done. So here's hoping to that. And that's it, everybody. I hope you enjoyed it. Ari Shaffir, Skeptic Tank, episode 35. The Jew, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. That's a good title, right? The Jew, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? Yeah, I like it. I'm going with it. Is come to a close. So thank you very much for tuning in. Please subscribe to this on iTunes. If you subscribe, you'll get them every week. And if you enjoy these, you know, I'm not organized enough to make merchandise or to fucking charge or to get any long-term, whatever they're called, people who give us money, sponsors. But tell a friend. Tell somebody else so that more people listen to it. That's all. I am organized enough to do that, to tell you guys to spread the word. That's it. I'll talk to you guys later, and have fun with no words of wisdom. All right, bye.